Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Room 42. I'm Liz Fraley from Single Sourcing Solutions. I'm your moderator. This is Janice Summers from TP Camp. She's our interviewer. And welcome to Dr. Eric James, today's guest in Room 42. Eric James has always been good at asking questions, often seeing multiple sides to complex issues. He's an associate professor of the Communication Studies Department at Metropolitan State University of Denver. He researches issues relating to workplace wellness, organizational identity, and control. He asks questions about the consequences of the ever-present creeping arm of managerial control. He's been published in a variety of outlets, including the Journal of Applied Communication Research and Management Communication Quarterly, and had a TED Talk just last month. Certainly, it's a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
The link you can find on the event page. And today, he's here to help us start answering the question, are your best intentions causing harm? Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this.
We're so glad you're here.
Yes, we're very glad to have you here. And, you know, it's an interesting, I've been thinking about the topic and you picked, it's a very challenging thing when you talk about workplace wellness and communication and all the other multifaceted aspects of that and how that impacts the workplace. What made you choose this area? This is a very sensitive area, right?
It is, yeah. And just as Liz said in the intro, I ask a lot of questions. I don't know if I have the answers, but when I started graduate school and I started reading about control and, you know, everything that we do for work, I was really, you know, just drawn to how pervasive work is in our lives. And I started digging right. a little bit deeper, and I read some work by one of my collaborators and really great researcher, Heather Zoller. And she had an article about working out as this kind of managerialist form of control. And I was like, that sounds interesting. And at the time I wasn't really into fitness or gyms, but I thought it was a very interesting approach. And so I started reading it and I just became fascinated with this, that a manager could basically prescribe fitness for employees. And I just started to take a step back and wonder, well, is that fair? I thought we were at work to, you know, produce widgets for whatever the company.
Perform a task, yeah.
Of course. So why would we be then making our employees conform to a particular, perhaps idealized standard of health? And from there, all sorts of questions came out. And Heather Zoller has done a great job at trying to answer some of those. But as that ever creeping arm of managerial control continues to reach out, there's other questions and more issues of control that we must look at and must ask.
And how is this impacting the employees? Like, and there's a lot to this. Like, I mean, is it overreach for companies to implement wellness programs?
I mean, that's a good question. So where do we get most of our health information? Because in the United States, we don't necessarily have a standardized health program that our government regulates and gives us information that makes it fair and easy for everyone to access. We don't have that. It's unfortunate, but we don't. And so if we are spending most of our awake time at work, then gosh, so should the employer give us information about health? You know, I see that perspective, but then who's to say that the manager or the corporate leaders, whoever they are going to give us the most universal standards or the most individualistic approaches to health versus a panacea, a one-size-fits-all approach. Now, if we're talking about seemingly innocuous things like, oh, let's just talk about health and there's this approach to nutrition and this approach, I think that that's a nice, like, all-encompassing way to present health information. But then again, I just always wonder, like, what is the incentive for the employer, right, to do this? Mm-hmm. And can the employee ever trust someone who inherently has a power position over that employee? Right. So it's very hard for that person in a lower position to resist that information.
Right. Because, I mean, there's biases there, right, from the employer's perspective.
There has to be. I mean,
they have motivations, right? Healthy employees, better performers, lower insurance experience, right?
Well, it's interesting. They do have a bias. We can't deny that. Everyone has a particular bias. But you know, when I talk to leaders about this, why are you implementing this particular program? And I look at some of the more extreme forms of workplace mm-hmm. health promotion. So we're talking about folks that are encouraging slash mandate. It just depends on if you look at the explicit norms or the implicit norms, which we can talk about in just a minute, to do perhaps a more extreme workout like CrossFit at the workplace, or eat a particular diet that the company has sponsored, or wellness programs have even evolved into getting more financial information, like how employees should budget their paychecks, right? So it becomes all encompassing. And while when I talk to these leaders about, hey, what was your motivation behind this? They say, altruistic. I'm doing this for my employees. I love them. I care about them. And yes, okay, I'll follow you to that point. But at the same time, then why would you be providing disincentives if they don't work out? Why would you be saying that they can't have maybe a soda pop on the shop floor? That they'll be fired if they drink or eat candy on the shop floor. So it's like, yeah, they care, but they're kind of carrying around a big stick as well. So it's like, well, okay, I'll do this for you.
Right. That kind of takes the altruism out of it.
It does. but yet they're given accolades, and you know, these companies that do have so-called healthy workplaces, they're often lauded in the literature, at least in terms of like functionalist perspectives, like folks that want to tweak particular parts of organizational culture to increase efficiency, productivity, lower insurance premiums. So they're often given awards about the potential return on investment, the ROI. But if you really do start digging into the data, it's very limited. It doesn't measure, as Zoller has said in the past, like it's very hard to measure the quality of a workplace health program. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, so what are you really calculating when you throw out these ROI numbers? And if you really do start digging around, you realize that a lot of them are not based off of substantive fact.
So what are the rewards that these employers are getting out of doing these? I mean, it sounds like the data shows that it really doesn't provide much benefit.
Well, it's interesting. We're kind of in this postmodern world where truth doesn't necessarily matter to a lot of folks. And that's really unfortunate. But a lot of folks that do, I often call these things like airport books. When you go in an airport and you look at the bookstore, there's all these business guru books and management guru stuff. And it's all about a quick fix, right? Mm-hmm. Enhancing teamwork, innovation, all these buzzwords that really don't mean a whole lot. And workplace wellness has become another variable that folks think they can simply tweak a small little thing and it's going to provide so many outstanding outcomes. And the reality of it is they don't want to look at the data that suggests that it's not easy to do. It's very complicated. Nutrition and health are very personal issues. Mm-hmm. And while we are seeing a bit of a change in this kind of cultural zeitgeist and what's happening right now with COVID, privacy laws are important. I don't necessarily want to share my health history with my employer. And I don't really want to necessarily be encouraged to eat a diet that perhaps goes against maybe a cultural value that I grew up with. And so these types of questions that are so important are often glossed over by the employers. Instead, they fixate on the potential insurance premium deductions. There's actually incentives with our government with tax credits for having particular healthy workers. It started with employee assistance programs, you know, with folks wanting their employers to stop smoking, to stop drinking, to cope with stress in better, more healthy ways.
Right.
But if you go back to that, it's like, well, where is your major source of stress? Work. So it's like, what comes first, chicken or the egg, right? And so it's just been a kind of a Band-Aid approach. We don't want to look too far into it. Don't go too deep, because then you realize that, gosh, well, work is causing many of these problems that we're trying to put a Band-Aid on to fix.
Right. So they're trying to solve it with the health and wellness programs when it's probably more of a managerial issue.
Yeah, I think,
stress,
management or just work in general. I mean, we have such a fixation on work in our country, across the world, really. But largely, right. I'd say that the American work ethic is, you know, based on Max Weber's understanding of the Protestant ethic, that if we do a good day's work, we'll be rewarded with fruits for our family. And a lot of that still exists, that work is important. We must do it. And I'm not necessarily disagreeing with that. I think that we need to have some sort of purpose in life. And that can be raising a family, or it can be also going to work or skiing or doing whatever we enjoy doing. And also paying the bills, of course. But when you start thinking about, okay, so where does it end? If I go to work, I get this information, I have a stressful day at work, and then I come home, well, I get a few emails, I'm still working. And then at night, I'm having a hard time sleeping because I'm thinking about my day or about my upcoming day. It's like, I can't even escape in my dreams. It's just like we said earlier, it's an all encompassing way of life these days. One of our big name scholars in organizational communication and communication in general, Stanley Dietz, who is emeritus at UC Boulder. And he talks about this idea of the corporate colonization, that we have all of these decisions that we make in life are often relegated or because of work, right? How often do we move to a new place just for the sake of a new adventure or fun? But we do move because of work. We got a transfer, right? Oh, dad got a transfer. We're now going to move to Milwaukee. Maybe not the best schools, but this is what we need to do for our family. And so I've often teased that with workplace wellness, it becomes almost like the corporate colon. Like, it's their body too. Like, they're now extending this to telling us what to eat and telling us how to be more productive and to eat to monitor our blood sugar levels.
They've advanced their reach from the 8-hour day into every aspect of our life, right? Because, you know, I imagine that having those wellness programs, you're always thinking about this and you're attached to work because that's what you do. In exchange for your time, you get money, which pays the bills, which allows you to have a place to live and all of that and some comfort. But having wellness programs that are overreaching and aggressive reaches into your conscious when you're trying to decide, what am I having for dinner? What am I feeding my family for dinner? How much sleep am I getting? You know, am I going to the gym enough? Am I, you know, going for a run? Am I, you know, whatever the fitness is, my Fitbit tracker, am I hitting the numbers that I have to hit in order to be on the reward board so that I get recognized in my job as a good employee because I'm getting my steps in? You know what I'm saying?
You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Seems like it seems like doing these things can put employees into a distress mode of constant pressure from the employer.
And a lot of them have said that they do not feel this pressure. It's kind of counterintuitive, right? But here's the thing. All those things that you were talking about have kind of creeped in to our lives that we take them for granted now. It becomes the assumption. So they're not, a lot of these employees may not necessarily understand that, oh, my workplace gave me a recommendation that I shouldn't eat any more potatoes. This is a true story based on my research, and that potatoes are bad for us for a variety of reasons. So I'm using kind of scare quotes here based on a particular nutritional doctrine that this organization prescribed. But what we can do instead is to perhaps make some rice cauliflower with our dinner. Now, I'm not going to argue that rice cauliflower is probably better for us than potatoes. But then when we start feeding that to your kiddos and you start really kind of taking in this particular discourse without question, it does kind of leave me with an uneasy feeling, because now that child is consuming this nutritional program that the organization, that the corporation has basically prescribed to their employees. And so in the 1800s, we had company towns where the coal miners would basically live in tent cities or small little houses and get paid in company dollars.
Have to go shop at the company store.
Company store, right? You know that song by I sold my soul
to the company store. This is true.
But now it's not as explicit as that, but it's kind of like this new neo-normative form of control, where scholars like Peter Fleming have talked about how this becomes like things that are typically outside of work now are becoming part of work. So think about the idea of play. Like fun and play. That's a new buzzword in organizational life, that we want to have fun while we work. And we want to be your true authentic selves, as long as that aligns with the company values, right? So you don't want someone who's going to be a rebel to come in and kind of buck the system, but you want someone to be themselves as long as it aligns.
As
long as it conforms, right?
Yourself inside this conformant box.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. So, and I was thinking, you know, the rice cauliflower is all well and good unless you, your grocery store nearest to your house is a gas station that doesn't carry that.
Right. That's the thing we need to talk about is people. I mean, we're not all on equal playing fields, right?
Exactly. That's the biggest issue for me is that it seems fine, right? It seems fine to give all your employees a Fitbit and say, hey, walk around and make a game of it. And hey, here's some nutritional information that follows this maybe Paleolithic diet or a zone diet. And it works. You're going to lose pounds. And but then you start thinking about, well, gosh, if I start buying these products, I mean, grass-fed beef is pretty expensive. Meat in general is pretty expensive. And yes. I'm only getting paid X amount of dollars. That's going to make it a little bit more challenging.
And what if you're vegan?
What if you're vegan? Or what if you grew up in a culture where a staple is something like rice and beans, and then you show up for Thanksgiving or for whatever holiday you're celebrating, and you're like, boss says I can't eat that anymore. Sorry, folks. You know, it's not really maybe that's taking it maybe a little bit too far, but at the same time, you can see how these things would just cause some incongruence in our lives about the choices that we're making and about, you know, that employer is not thinking that there are food deserts out there and that shopping at the organic stores versus the cheaper grocery stores is an option for people when they're simply not giving those higher paychecks to many of the employees that are being fed this nutrition information.
Right. And are they thinking of the exclusionary practice? Like how a lot of these programs are very exclusionary.
Yeah. I don't think that's the first thing that comes to mind. And I really think that's unfortunate because I was in a meeting doing some research for my dissertation, and this company was really big into fitness for their employees. They were just evangelical about it. Part of it was because their brand probably depended on them being a fitness culture. But at the same time, when I was observing this meeting, I was frantically taking notes about everything that I was hearing and just trying not to just blurt out like, what in the heck are you guys doing? The manager said with a straight face, all right, folks, we're going to do something a little bit more aggressive here. Every time that we see someone taking the elevator to get to the second or third floor, you're going to get a fine. You're going to go in this kind of swear jar. You'll have to pay a fine for taking the elevator. We want you taking the steps. And it was really interesting at this organization, they would have a whiteboard at the top of the steps where you're supposed to time how quickly you got from the bottom floor to the top. And then I was just standing around and there were some other folks that were kind of laughing and chuckling, but I honestly sensed some kind of nervous laughter.
Yeah.
Like, you know, what if someone has a disability or there's some sort of, there are times in the day where you just don't feel like taking the stairs for a variety of reasons.
Right.
What kind of a culture is that going to be when you're surveilling who takes the stairs, the preferred employee versus an employee who chooses to take, or doesn't even choose, but just has to take the elevator. And so as I was writing this down, they just kind of, the manager looked at me like what's wrong with that? Just simply missing how exclusive that practice was and what some of those consequences might've been.
Yeah, because what does that do to the employees in the environment? I mean, you know, when you've gone in and consulted with companies, have you gotten a chance to have candid interviews with employees? Like, how do you track that?
It's interesting because, you know, with any kind of exclusive practice, it creates in-group and out-groups, right? It's just kind of social identity theory or self-categorization. And the in-group folks were evangelical about this. You know, I like to call them the homers of the organization. Yes, sir. Anything you want? Yes, I'll do it. And they loved it. And they saw results. They got fit. They just really were enamored by it and were all in, it seemed like. But then you find some that are in the middle of the road that said, well, it was kind of weird that like we were all required to do this workout, but they didn't do any injury screening. And, you know, I'm a personal trainer. They would say that they're a personal trainer. And that just, you know, struck me as a little bit odd that you can't necessarily prescribe this for everyone without knowing their individual health history.
Right.
And then some on the other end, the resistors maybe had worked for an organization for 20, 30 years, have had children, had had, you know, life happens. And maybe their bodies weren't exactly how idealized in the modern sense, or even what they preferred, but just life happens. And so when they are being told to eat a particular way, to change their diet, to work out a particular way, many of them told me they hate it. They hate working there. They didn't feel comfortable eating in front of other employees. They were eating in their cars. They were eating at their desks.
Constantly judged.
constantly judged. They self-categorize themselves as baddies. It's their word. And that's so unfortunate because you can still be healthy choosing your own path. And in that particular case, I think that research was really fruitful in that we saw that resistance, those folks that were able to voice, it was hard for them to talk to me, right? Because, those are very personal issues.
Yes.
I then brought those issues up to the C-suite. And I remember very vividly that conversation. I was talking to this HR executive and I said, well, are you worried that these practices might at some point ostracize particular employees? Because I have heard from some that do feel like this has changed the workplace. It is quite different.
Yeah.
And I'll remember exactly what he said and the way in which he said it. He said, well, is that true? Or is that just how they feel? And I thought that was a really telling perspective because in organizational communication, we have this thing about like bounded emotionality. Like there's a particular way for us to privilege more masculine ways of thinking, stereotypically masculine ways of thinking in leadership, which is more logic and truth, and really kind of taking emotion and feeling and putting that off to the side, like not as valuable as, you know, logic or truth. But that comment by him just really showed me that he didn't really care about that group that might have felt ostracized because in his mind they were doing a good thing. And he used that word altruism so much in that conversation. So just a complete disconnect altogether.
That's kind of sometimes the drum that they beat to hide behind. And they're thinking that the data points in fitness relate to health. But very what good. They don't understand is that does not indicate health. Fitness does not indicate health.
Well, what's interesting period. About that? It's fascinating because, you know, I love studying communication because we show the power of language, the power of words, the by just naming something, we can give it a particular judgment or evaluation. And so what CrossFit has done in the past, CrossFit's an extreme workout program.
Yes.
They were kind of smart in more of a sinister way because they defined health. And so they said that you're sick, you're unwell if you are eating carbs and that you're only working out by like running or something. And that if you want to be healthy, then you're the elite athlete that does not eat any carbs, who brags about not having sushi in, you know, years, and is able to excel in a variety of sports. And so if you take that definition from an exercise or lifestyle ideology and incorporate that into the workplace, you run into a whole bunch of problems.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is they're defining health and they're not doctors.
No, absolutely not. It's so hard for even doctors to tell us what is healthy or what should we do in this way or that way, because it's individual. It comes down to the person. It comes down to your genetics. Sure. Yes. It comes down to your nutritional choices and your activity. Absolutely. But it's a lot of different factors that the organization does not simply have access to, right? They're, you know, they focus on widgets. They don't focus on the human body.
Well, which, you know, I mean, if these companies discover that true health is, you know, a lot of tests that doctors run and they study you over a period of time to find out how your health is through various modes. Like there's a lot of things they test and measure on an individual basis. Now, heaven help us when companies figure out that that's true health, because then are they going to try to overreach into that?
Yeah, I worry about this. As we talked about earlier, the neo-normative control, it seems to be encompassing everything. There's a scholar in the UK, Karen Dale, who, you know, wonders about that movie, what was it called? Limitless, where you take a, you know, some sort of a pill and your body can now do things it hadn't done before. So what's to say that a particular organization is not going to say, hey, you know what, you should probably take some of these pills as well, because it's going to enhance your productivity during the day. Mm-hmm. And there is research that suggests that some doctors, in fact, who are working, you know, long double shifts, who are lacking sleep, have taken amphetamines to help stay awake. And so, yeah, I do really worry about what's next. I would say that, you know, prescribing CrossFit and that ideology to your employees is a bit far. It's pretty extreme, but gosh, I really do wonder about the future of work and what we're going to give, how much permission we're going to allow our employers to have over us.
So what does one do? You know, that's the thing. It's like, you get a job as a technical writer at a company. I'm there to do a technical writing job. I'm not there to, you know, go run a marathon. I'm not there to, you know, be the next CrossFit star. I'm there to do my job and I'm good at my job.
Yeah. But then you start walking around, you see on the walls, all the good employees who have had these fitness feats, as you were saying earlier, Janice, about the ideal employees and their scores for fitness and the cool employees that are eating together with the senior leadership because they all worked out together. And yeah, you're just there to do your job. You're a technical writer. Okay. But I think you would feel a little bit excluded because you weren't part of that club, that you weren't part of the group that was, for lack of better terms, it becomes a good old boys club. And yes, it is very gendered as well, because a lot of these fitness programs do, you know, CrossFit says it caters to everyone, but when you really start digging down, you know, it does privilege particular ideals and it kind of caters to a particular class. It's very expensive usually. And to follow a paleo diet is not only, you know, destructive for the environment, but if you're eating a lot of protein, but at the same time, it's not appropriate for everyone.
Wow. It feels like a socially acceptable way to be completely anti-diverse, anti-inclusive, and end up with a whole lot of people who all look like you.
That's a great point, right? These companies will say that they have commitments to diversity and commitments to not being a homogenous, you know, one size person at the organization, but that we want a variety of perspectives. But, you know, and again, I asked someone during my interviews with them, I said, so, I mean, you can't necessarily discriminate against people that aren't going to follow these ideals and that maybe don't take fitness as, you know, seriously as other folks. And he kind of laughed and said, we can't.
And not a protected class.
And so he was kind of joking about it. Like he would never admit, you know, that they, you know, fire or only hire fit looking people. But at the same time, we kind of use that term cultural fit as like this really nebulous phrase that might actually lead to more discrimination than doing good. Because, you know, these folks that are working out, if you do CrossFit, you have kind of an idealized body. It's a very small body fat percentage. It looks a particular way. And so my other research, I talk about how your body becomes almost like a resume. Like if you have your vita, your resume on paper, but doesn't your body also communicate your particular values? And you know, we can't really hide our bodies. It's unfortunate that we have to go in for our interviews and, you know, people will make those judgments. And
well, yeah, they do. And oftentimes those judgments are absolutely wrong. And that CrossFit person, you can't see their arteries hardening from all the food that they're eating in their diet,
right? Some people drop dead anyway.
You can't see all those hardening arteries and the long-term effects of all of that. But there's got to be a boundary, though. There's got to be a good way to communicate this and to live healthy, to promote health in a company. There's got to be.
Sure. Yeah.
Right? So how would you do that? How would you communicate that and be inclusive?
Yeah, it's a good question. Again, I asked this question too, and there are some folks within communication, specifically health communication, that talk about this for more kind of participatory, democratic models of decision-making in the organization. I'm of the belief that that's kind of a utopia, but we can hope to get there at some point, maybe crossing my fingers. But we need to have folks that are on the floor that maybe don't have that direct power over subordinates to help in the process, to feel comfortable enough to kind of be part of the co-constructors of these particular health messages, understanding that you cannot just have this one size fits all, that it has to be co-created and it has to be individualistic. And it certainly cannot be kind of governed by a big stick where there's these, you know, disincentives to work out. I mean, when we think about where these programs started, Mm-hmm. We think about employee assistance programs to cope with stress, to curb mm-hmm. tobacco and alcohol use, because you know that's how folks, a lot of folks turn to cope. Mm-hmm. And so I see that as, you know, as good, right? The I mean, all this started with occupational safe and health awareness, right? It, mm-hmm. And how we can stop basically being killed at our jobs and reduce injuries. And so we've come a long way since, you know, one of the number one, you know, ways to die in America was from our jobs mm-hmm. to trying to get, you know, people to be really happy, to have longevity. But it's taken on a much more nefarious tone. And mm-hmm. we need to step back from it and realize that you cannot have 100% participation in everything. While you right. may have 90% participation, and that may seem good, I'm very concerned about that 10%. Right. Those are the folks that are in the margins that we may not hear from. So I might want to cater to those folks and know that my role as an employer does have a boundary. And we need to, I think yeah, we do need to have some regulation there that, mm-hmm. you know, that we can't be fired because of the way that our body looks or because of the ways that we choose to work out, or if I have a Coke on the shop floor.
Right. Well, and it's interesting because I'm listening and I'm thinking at the same time, a lot of times some of these things come from the C-suite, right? Or you have somebody who's type A, super aggressive into fitness, who's in a position of power in the company, who's dictating it down and you know, coloring it however they want. But that's usually how these things come about. Yes?
Absolutely. It's top down. It's
so it's interesting. Kind of go with me here. Sure. So what if they took this and they took a lesson out of the skill in communication, and they say, okay, so I've got this product, right? The executive who wants this thing, but I've got this audience and these two things are far apart. So I'll include my audience before I design a program and implement it, right? And communicate, I will design it with my customer in mind. My customer in that situation is the entire spectrum of my employee base. I'll have them involved so that I'll have a stronger program and more inclusive program, right?
Interesting idea.
Yeah.
Because if I come from a perspective of communication and organization, or just from the traditional tech comm, we know that if we communicate to our base, they understand better, right? And that's our job in tech comm, is to make complex things easy to understand and for people to adopt and implement. And in order to do that, we need to understand our customer base.
I completely
and we have
agree.
To understand the complexity of the product, right? So this executive, and then we know how to negotiate that and design a program around that to communicate.
Yeah, I love that idea. It's kind of like you're going back to, you know, ancient Greece. Aristotle said this, right? Yeah. Know your audience, know who
yes.
you're talking to.
Yeah.
So it's so cyclical that we forget just the basics. Like, you know, if you're the CEO, you have a very different lifestyle than many of
yes.
your employees. So during an interview, could you
yeah.
ask some questions to find out more about what they want in their employer? Do they even want workplace wellness? And if they could have workplace wellness, what would it look like? Could we
right.
have some sort of a process in place to get to know what those needs are and if there is a need for it? Clearly,
right.
we have a structural problem in the United States about health and access to health information. And
mm-hmm.
even recently, it's not just the marginalized communities that have this distrust in our doctors and our medical advice. A lot of folks now are having this distrust. And so I think it, you know, not to just bring everything back to COVID-19, but I do think this is an interesting rupture point in the way that we think about health and wellness. And I hope that we can just really, you know, we can just shut up for a minute and listen to our employees and know kind of where they're coming from and what they want, and hopefully making a climate, this kind of culture that encourages participation, that encourages decision-making processes across
right.
the board, not just from the top down.
Right. Well, and from an organizational perspective, from that org psychology mentality, we know that a body as a whole is stronger when we have more diversity and inclusion. Right? We know this. So you can't have hyper aggressive people all the through the whole company, because that doesn't work. You have some that are aggressive, some that are not. You have some that are very introverted and some that are extroverted. This symphony creates a stronger organization, a stronger body, as it were, right?
But again, it's not just that. It does completely. And that would help the bottom line for many of these organizations, because if you're just having that evangelical fitness group, yeah, those are like-minded ideas. They're going to come from those folks. But gosh, don't you want the other ideas that are perhaps even more creative? Or, you know, we can direct initiatives to bring their ideas into our potential customers and clients. I would argue absolutely. And, you know, I hate to bring things back to the business case, right? But if our organizations are simply driven by the bottom line, and I would argue that they are, at least our for-profits, that there is a way for us to kind of, again, I'm kind of skeptical and hesitant to do this, but there is a way to look at it from that business case, that there are some actual opportunities that are being missed right now by kind of homogenizing our workforce.
Absolutely. There's real valid, there's valid reason that you want to have a healthy work environment, both, you know, emotionally, physically, everything. You want that to be healthy. But in order to create that, you can't be so homogenous with just one program and super aggressive and only the cool kids and hyper competitive, because that's
have access to power.
That's non-inclusive. So you're going to miss what eventually happens is, you know, if you're building too much in one thing, then you will crumble. Eventually you will crumble. If you want sustainability over a long period of time, you have to have inclusion. So you have to have a program that is diverse and includes a broad spectrum, because not everybody is going to fit into that one spectrum, right? And you can't judge health on physical appearance. You cannot.
But we shouldn't judge health, right? Mm-hmm. No one should judge health other than if you want to, yourself. Like, you're in control of your body to a certain extent. Genetics definitely play a role. Right. But it's definitely not of the purview of my manager.
No.
And even when someone comments on appearance in the workplace, sometimes I get a little, you know, I'm taken back a bit by someone commenting on just my body, right? Because it's a personal thing. And when you're starting to be not only, I mean, those are seemingly innocuous comments like, oh, you look tired today. I see some bags under your eyes. Are you okay? Okay, I'll let that go. But when it's like, oh, how's working out going? How's the workout today? Did you make your way to the gym yet? Which class are you going to go to? And it's, you're hearing that everywhere. Well, if I don't feel very good, I've, you know, just turned 40 and I'm really feeling the aches and pains of my body. I don't have cartilage in my knees and my shoulder hurts. I don't want to work out today. And so I don't think I should be judged for that, because gosh, you don't know everything that I've been through. You don't know that, you know, there's no cartilage in my knees and I can't bend down very well right now. So it just creates this in-group, out-group bias where organizations are really thinking about ways to control employees' bodies and not necessarily the task at hand.
Mm-hmm.
It's a veneer, not so much a real concern.
Yeah, some folks in the UK, Peter Bloom, Essex, and Timothy Butcher in Tasmania, we're working on a project together that we're really thinking from a theoretical perspective, the capital that we have with our bodies. And if it's almost to the extent of like, you know, those obstacle races of like Tough Mudder, Spartan Race, those types of things. Do you know that those folks actually run through live electricity? They run through electricity. They cause their body's pain. They jump into freezing water. They crawl through barbed wire. And so their body is being, to some extent, it's being bruised. It's being battered. But it's that pain. Other scholars have talked about this too, that pain becomes kind of like a battle scar that you want to show that you've endured it, that you can do that. And for some reason, that's become this proxy for success or for a good, a high quality candidate. And this isn't just, you know, speculation. This there's a CEO who has a video out from Skull Candy. It's one of the headphone manufacturers in Parkson, Utah.
Right.
And he said on record that he uses CrossFit as a great proxy to see who would succeed in his company.
Nice.
Okay, maybe, but maybe a CrossFitter would use your headphones. And I know I'm knocking a lot on CrossFit. CrossFit does have some commitments to health and fitness that I think that a lot of people do get some benefit out of. Absolutely. And I'm really inspired by their new leadership. Greg Glassman has gone away, thank goodness. And Eric Rosa is up in Boulder and doing some really great things trying to make it more inclusive. And a paleo diet, as much as I knock it, it does work for a lot of people. And I know they're not as focused on meat proteins and ways to use more renewable sources and vegetables. So I want to be fair to, if that is your preferred nutritional program or your preferred way to work out, I don't want to knock that too hard. What I'm saying is that that should be your choice. That should be your sense of agency. And the body capital thing is just that I think oftentimes we don't work out. Well, in certain cases, I shouldn't say everyone, but let's take a hypothetical example that we might work out to build our body, to sculpt our body in a particular way that society deems exceptional, not just professional anymore, right? The professional body is one thing, but it's changing. Now we need to stand out. We need to be exceptional. And the exceptional person brags about not having, in this particular organization I'm working with, having sushi in 10 years. And to me, I'm like, gosh, I love sushi. I don't know how I could give that up. In fact, it sounds really good for lunch today. So I just, I think that sometimes we make those sacrifices and, you know, we're only on this earth for a short amount of time. And I think that when we start really using that extreme discipline, that we're kind of giving into that managerialist control, that discourse that says, I'll do everything for my job.
Right. And it comes back to that again. It's like, what does that have to do with me making widgets?
Exactly.
Right? Are you going to make them faster? Widgets, yeah. And I'm doing a great job making widgets. Great. Right. Because I don't think it's fair for managers to overreach and dictate to me and my family. What if I've got, you know, children that I'm raising, is that's creeping into their lives too. Right.
It really is. You know, in the turn of the century, we looked at scientific management theory. So it's like one best way to do a job. And to some extent, we still have that. And I can understand like, hey, there's a more efficient way to do something. Let me show you how to do that. Okay, I'll buy that. But what if you start saying that, hey, there's a more efficient way to even control your body, to put particular nutrients in there that's going to make you more alert and more productive on the work floor? I struggle with that because, you know, evolution takes a very long time to happen. Mm-hmm. We are not faster. The human body, you know, I'll argue this, the human body is not different than it was 200 years ago. You may say, well, Eric, gosh, don't we run the 4-minute mile a lot quicker than we used to? And I'd say, well, yeah, we are faster. We see records being broken in Olympics and things like this. But is it really that the body is getting stronger and faster? Or do we have a more nuanced understanding of, you know, efficient movements or ways to train or technology, the shoes that we wear, right? And I would argue it's the latter. It's the technology that has changed. The human body is going to take hundreds of thousands of years for us to evolve, if we even do at this with what's going on right now. And so for us to think that we can keep improving continuously, it's missing the whole point that, hey, work is a means to survive. And there needs to be particular borders and a perimeter that's clearly defined around that organizational structure.
Yeah. I think that's the important thing. And you were talking about that early on, are those boundaries are really important to have those, to be able to detach so that you can get the mental break, right? The emotional break, the physical break from your work day. Because you do spend a lot of time, right, at work.
You spend an awful lot of time. Most of your awake time in life, if you're in America, is at work. And if you're, you know, thinking about work, if I don't know about you all, but there is a particular performance that happens at work, right? That you are expected to be professional. Now, professional is socially constructed, and I don't even know what that is anymore because it changes on a daily basis. But at the same time, we have to, you know, be on for that period of time. And that's exhausting, especially for someone like me. I'm an introvert. So when I give a lecture or something like this, it wipes me out. I come home and talk to my family. I try to have energy for them, but sometimes it's hard.
You need a rest. And that's an interesting thing because the majority of performers, truth be told, are introverts. They can perform because they take on a role, but it's exhausting. So we can perform at work. We're taking on a role. We're doing our job. And it's exhausting. We need a break.
Now imagine that, standing on the floor all day long in a blue collar facility. And by blue collar work, I mean like industrial, let's say you're a welder. There's actually organizations, believe it or not, that are blue collar that do prescribe CrossFit before work. Yeah, no joke. And you know, they have chiropractors and nutritionists, they're self-insured. And it just brings about a whole slew of questions. And yet these organizations they're given accolades, Healthy Employer of the Year. And it's missing the boat. People are seeing what they want to see and thinking this is the answer to our healthcare crisis in America, but it's not. I think it's perpetuating the exclusive practices that we've really always had, but just in a different way.
Yeah. And perpetuating lack of diversity and inclusion. I hate to say this, but our time is already up. I think we've gone a little longer, but I'm sorry. I just really enjoyed this conversation.
I got wrapped up. I didn't stop watching the clock.
I could go longer, but I'm getting this red thing flashing over on the side here saying time's up. It's been flashing for a little while.
I feel really passionate about this subject. If anyone does have questions or would like to bounce ideas off of me, I'd love to chat more about it. So feel free to email me, hit me up wherever you can.
Yeah, I think this has been a great conversation. And it's wonderful because it brings up even more issues or more questions. And, you know, not that we've got the answer to any of this, but I think stimulating conversation opens up for interesting and creative answers.
Well, I think that is the answer. I can't give you the panacea. I can't, if I want to get close, it's talking about, you know, shutting up as the employer and listening and just listening to what those needs are and creating a climate of trust in your organization.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thank you again for joining us. We really appreciate it. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it, folks. Thanks for having me.